It is a thing you need to continue to work on because it doesn't go conveniently away after a funeral or, you know, memorial service or anything like that. And it comes in waves, you know, it will hit you unexpectedly. Something will remind you of a person. It could be an event. It could be a smell, something you hear. And suddenly you're, you know, kind of drowning in some memories and you got tears in your eyes and people are looking at you funny and you're like, what? So you have to understand that that is going to happen sometimes and it's okay. And one of the things that the reason it became a theme in the Seven Kennings is that I had been reading quite a bit of epic fantasy where there's these giant battles and some pretty emotional stuff, but there's some brutal killings and torture and whatever going on. And the characters didn't seem to be feeling any of it. They were okay with some of that stuff. And I was like, this is a little weird. You think they'd be a little bit more, you know, broken up by it? Maybe. Hey, maybe they're sociopaths, you know? So maybe I have to consider that instead. Maybe that was intentional. But if it isn't intentional, you know, why are we skipping over like a huge part of human existence?
What is up, everybody? You're listening to episode 82 of SFF Addicts. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. Joining me as always is my co-host, the Chewie to my Han Solo, the Joker to my Commander Shepard, MJ Kuhn. How are you, MJ?
Hello. I am doing well. How are you?
Doing very well. Having a peachy keen evening. And peachy keen. You know? Yeah. Hanging out with Kevin Hearn and stuff. And if you want to support MJ and her work, you can pick up Among Thieves and its sequel, Thick as Thieves, a complete duology for all your thieving needs. Go check this out.
Ooh, that like rhymed. That was very Seussian of you. I appreciate it. That was great.
I've been reading Dr. Seuss to my son for a while, so I'm all up on that.
I got it.
Yeah, but go support MJ and her work because she's awesome and her books are awesome. And I burned through them and you're going to love them. As well, a quick note for everyone out there listening or watching, the official SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live, so check the links in the description to support what we do here. Also, don't forget to rate and review the podcast on your favorite podcast app and subscribe to the FanFight YouTube channel where this and every other episode of the show is available in full video. And now joining us once again is the wonderful Kevin Hearn, author of the Seven Kennings trilogy, the Iron Druid Chronicles, and more. How are you, Kevin?
I'm pretty darn spiffy. How are you guys doing?
Peachy keen, man. Spiffy, peachy keen.
Yeah. Spiffy. I love it. Shit. We're like talking like we're like from the 1950s.
Right. I'm going to go get myself a malted later. At the soda fountain.
At the soda fountain. And that's why we're doing a masterclass on working through grief, because we're all so peachy keen.
Yeah. What a transition, Adrian.
Oh my God, I'm on fire today. This is part two of our two-part chat with Kevin, so I recommend checking out part one to get to know him better. Today, though, we're having a group therapy session, so we're going to talk about working through grief in its many facets. But to get started with this most therapeutic of masterclasses, Kevin, can you tell us what has your lived experience taught you about grief?
Well, it is a thing you need to continue to work on because it doesn't go conveniently away after a funeral or, you know, memorial service or anything like that. And it comes in waves, you know, it will hit you unexpectedly. Something will remind you of a person. It could be an event. It could be a smell, something you hear. And suddenly you're, you know, kind of drowning in some memories and you got tears in your eyes and people are looking at you funny and you're like, what? So you have to understand that that is going to happen sometimes, and it's okay. And one of the things that the reason it became a theme in the Seven Kennings is that I had been reading quite a bit of epic fantasy where there's these giant battles and some pretty emotional stuff, but there's some brutal killings and torture and whatever going on. And the characters didn't seem to be feeling any of it. They were okay with some of that stuff. And I was like, this is a little weird. You think they'd be a little bit more, you know, broken up by it? Maybe. Hey, maybe they're sociopaths, you know? So maybe I have to consider that instead. Maybe that was intentional. But if it isn't intentional, you know, why are we skipping over like a huge part of human existence? And the fact that we all have to deal with this to some extent, you know, if you're not dealing with it now, just wait. You will. It's going to happen. So it's not just grief, but all kinds of trauma. And I kind of, you know, am making sure that in the Seven Kennings that when these folks do experience grief, they have to work through it. And it is a process. It is not something that just takes one page. It is a theme that needs to show up over and over and also be experienced by pretty much every character to one sense or another, because in this incredible giant war that's happening, and I don't mean giant as in large, although it is that, but giant as in actual giants. So, you know, there's quite a bit of grief to go around. So we have everybody kind of process it, and some of them process it different ways, which is, of course, mirroring reality. So, that's kind of the main theme that I was kind of exploring through this, and I have found that it actually wound up helping people, and I know this because they told me. So,
yeah, well, we'll get to that. But why do you think? Because, you know, you touched on it a little bit in the sense that, like, why are these characters not really reflecting something that is so integral to the human experience, you know? And from your perspective, why do you think grief and trauma are so integral to the human experience? And would you necessarily look at it as a bad thing?
As grief and trauma being bad? Mm-hmm. I think they have the potential to be bad if you don't grapple with it. That they can both take you to dark places and you don't get out. It can ruin your life if you don't deal with it. So, you see this. I saw it quite a bit, actually, when I was a teacher. You know, if you had a kid in your class who abruptly lost a parent or a grandparent or, you know, anybody that they were close to, you could see how it really deeply affected them. And sometimes it would be a couple of bad days and then sort of kind of normal after that. Maybe they stabilized, steadied out, whatever. And then sometimes they got really wrecked by it. And so you have to not only see that in that situation, but I mean, you have to consider that everybody's going to have to deal with it at some point. And again, what I was sort of seeing, I in some stories that I was reading, they weren't really processing it. And I'm not blaming anybody for that, because the author was actually probably thinking about something else. You know, they were so focused on writing some other part of the story, they had some other point they wished to make, that was not, you know, in the forefront of their minds. And so that's cool. That's fine. That's legit. It's valid and all that. We do probably need to talk about it a little bit sometimes. So I think it is a huge part of all of our lives, you know, and I touched on it a little bit in the Iron Druid Chronicles beforehand. In Hammered, for example, Atticus says farewell to the Widow McDonagh before he goes off to Asgard, because he doesn't know if he's coming back and he doesn't know if this is the last time he's going to see her or not. And so he wants to tell her while he has the chance that she's a beautiful person, and that's something he should have said, you know, something we should tell each other whenever we can. And we often don't. We often pass up that chance to be real with each other. And so he wanted to make sure he took that opportunity, because he's lived long enough to know that if I don't take this opportunity, I'm going to regret it hugely later on. This was born out of the fact that I lost both my father and my grandmother. They were both ill and I was far away and I didn't get to be there, you know, at the end. And I didn't get to say the things that I wanted to say. So this was a way for me to kind of process that little episode of the Iron Druid Chronicles. But then there's a lot of other stuff too. You know, there's a lot of other things that happen ways that you have to, or situations. Just sometimes somebody leaves the world very violently rather than from illness. And so that's a different bag of chips that you have to grapple with. So especially in the Seven Kennings. So we work through that a little bit too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think so. We've talked to a lot of writers that have actually, you know, talked about using writing their own books as kind of therapy, right? That they're working through their own emotions as they're writing them. But I do think that reading is another way that, you know, can help us process a lot of those really heavy emotions, grief and trauma, kind of, you know, seeing your own experience reflected in another soul, even if it's just fictional, right? So do you remember the first time or a particularly impactful time when reading something really helped you process something? And what was it about that particular work that struck that chord for you?
I was reading, okay, I don't remember the exact book, all right? But I remember reading about some story in which a bully that, you know, that's been kind of tormenting the protagonist is revealed to have some serious shit going on at home. And the reason they are the way they are is not just because they woke up and they're mean, but because they are lashing out and reacting to some pretty terrible stuff, you know, closer to home for them. And that made me reevaluate the bullies in my own life, you know? So it made me think about, well, God, you know, now if I see somebody being mean, I'm like, gosh, who hurt you, man? You know, what are you dealing with? Are you all right? Can, you know, maybe we could see somebody about this and you wouldn't have to be a jerk anymore. so that's kind of, what, you know, that's an experience from reading that really helped me. And the way I kind of look at it now, because if you're writing about something that's kind of deep and heavy or whatever, think of it as like a giant ball of metal slag that a blacksmith might have. Way too hot and nasty to handle, even if you got protective gloves on. But if you got a pair of tongs, you can manipulate and hammer at that, you know, and get rid of, you know, all of the nastiness of that piece of molten metal. And shape it into something new that's going to serve you. And that's really what fiction does. I think of fiction as the tongs, okay? When you're reading a story, those are the tongs that can help you address an issue, you know, fill in the blank here. In this case, it's grief. But, you know, whatever that issue is, fiction will allow you to keep that dangerous stuff at a safe distance and then it will allow you to kind of work through it on your own and apply it to your own life. So I think that's one of the wonderful magical things, you know, like you were saying, MJ, about fiction. It is a way for us to experience things maybe we haven't yet, and then maybe we're prepared for it when it does happen to us. You know, it really does help you in every facet of your life. Just be a more empathetic, kinder, more well-rounded human being.
Yeah, and I think fantasy and science fiction, and I would also put horror into this, are such potent tools for dealing with these kinds of experiences and immense emotions like trauma and grief and whatnot. Why do you think that separation of something like fantasy or sci-fi or horror better allows us to kind of tackle these things? You mentioned the ability for fiction to distance and act as like the tongs, but I think there's, you know, you could go from like literary fiction and still be able to experience that kind of thing. But then what might fantasy, sci-fi, and horror bring to that kind of experience?
Well, you got me thinking about genres, first of all. Like, I really enjoy reading romance, you know, for the focus on the interpersonal relationships and, you know, that it basically gives you an insight into, you know, the romance writers do that better than anybody else. You know, how do we negotiate relationships with each other? I think that is fantastic, right? And so romance is really keenly able to do that. Whereas, science fiction, fantasy, and horror can, you know, help you deal with some of the more darker and scarier things sometimes. Not, which is not to say that relationships can't be scary, but, you know, you have other kinds of scary stuff going on with fantasy and so on. So I'm not sure what it is about them that allows us to access it easier. I haven't really thought of it in those terms before. So well done on the question, sir. You know, I just know that I look at almost every story as a way to process something because, like you said, every author is processing something. Probably they've got something they want to get off their chest, and they're going to make that come out in their story. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. I stumped you, man.
You did. You totally did. Well done. You
got those good questions, Adrian. Yeah. Well, that's, I love the central theme of grief in The Seven Canon, because you're right. It's not something that you see a lot of people explore. I've talked before about how I think that in fantasy, it's like a useful tool to like explore kind of darker themes or things that people wouldn't accept from something that they see in reality because it is so othered. I think that can be useful, but I do think a lot of times that does result in characters like seeing, experiencing, doing heinous things and really just then kind of like moving on with their lives, which again, there could be a space for that, but I do love with The Seven Kettings that you were like, nah, we're not going to do that. So can you build upon that choice and how it affected the ways that you approach the series, the characters, the relationships, in that story?
Well, part of the reason that this came to my attention or realized that this was a problem that maybe I could at least try to address is we were seeing a lot of news back when I was writing it about, you know, huge floods of refugees coming from war-torn areas in the world and, you know, trying to just flee with their families to safety. And whether it was the United States or somewhere in Europe or whatever, they're trying to go to these you know, different countries from where they're at, where the war is going on. And then finding out that where they want to go is like, no, you can't come in here because we are huge dicks and we're not going to help you. That was kind of the attitude that a lot of countries were having. And I'm like, guys, come on. We're all on the same planet here. And if they need some help, let's help them out. And so I was donating to refugee charities and stuff like that. And then realizing also there wasn't very much going on about refugees or, you know, just the dire straits that regular citizenry was having to deal with, because a lot of stories focus on the hero and what the hero's doing, but they're not really paying attention to the vast swaths of people that are uprooted and their lives kind of ruined or changed, you know, forever by this war. So I wanted to make that a focus of it. And so the bard is, you know, starting out a plague of giants, facing a field of refugees that are camped outside of the city walls of Pelamon. And they, you know, they have a lot of needs that right now they're getting most of the basic needs met, but he's letting them know, well, you know, how did we all get here? Sort of like that Talking Head song. Well, how did I get here? You know, and that's, he's kind of processing everything with them. And one of the things that is sort of a thing that, puts a twist in this is that the bard has a perfect memory. So when he has a traumatic event, he can't forget it. Time does not heal it. He's got to relive things quite a bit. So he's got a different set of traumas and things to work through than everybody else because he really can't escape it. It keeps coming back. So did I answer your question or did I ramble in a completely different direction and never answer it?
No, this you absolutely answered it.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, good. I'm glad. Actually, sometimes I forget. When I was a teacher, my students, you know, they'd be like, let's ask Kurt a question and see where he goes. Let's see how long we can get him off track.
Oh my gosh. I used to play that game in school too. Yeah.
It's a great game. No, I played it too. Yeah. But then also laughed at myself for being susceptible to it. So,
yeah. It just means you were the cool teacher, for the record.
Oh yeah, that's what it is. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm gonna hold on to that.
Because they knew that they could mess around with you and you would handle it well.
Yeah,
there you go. You
wouldn't get mad. But what you said about the bard and his perfect memory and like the fact that it was much more difficult for him to let go of the trauma and let go of these things that he couldn't forget. We were talking to Greta Kelly recently, and she has in her new novel, The Queen of Days, this race of people who are perceived as gods by normal human beings, but in reality, they're kind of like time demons, but they don't forget, and their concept of time is different. And so they process things that happened centuries ago with grudges that continue over a long, long period of time, and memories that continue over long periods of time. And I think it's interesting that you brought that up, because it's like the ways in which human memory works. We so often suppress trauma by suppressing the memories themselves. And so what a lot of people go through in terms of therapy or psychedelics or different avenues of kind of awakening those traumas in order to finally be able to deal with them again. Yeah. And you had some good examples there with the Seven Cannings, and you mentioned earlier an example from the Iron Druid Chronicles. Do you have any other characters or scenes or moments that you can remember being particularly analogous to what you were experiencing and feeling at that time? And, and, you know, how difficult is it to translate how you're dealing with grief into the fictional experiences of a character?
Well, one of the, so the bard tells stories of folks all around the continent, and he jumps back into the past quite a bit to tell those stories. But he always comes back to a present day narrative, and where the guy who's actually writing down his stuff, his name is Dervin. Dervin is dealing with grief of his own because his wife was an actual spy and she got assassinated. So he's processing that. But at the same time, he has a refugee family living with him in his house now. He's got the space. He's welcomed these folks in to have a place to sleep. And it's a woman named Elenea and her two kids, Tamod and Perella. And their father, the kid's father, you know, Elenea's husband, was killed by the giants in a different city. And they have fled to this city, you know, to be safe. But they're obviously all wrecked by the fact that, you know, their family's been, you know, truncated here. And Elenea is really closed off and not very communicative and all of that kind of stuff, and doesn't smile. I mean, she's really having a difficult time with it. And Dervin tries to give her a framework to deal with grief. And he's not sure how well it works. He doesn't think it does, in fact, but he tries. And he is also wondering, you know, he doesn't know who killed his wife. He knows that she was killed, but he doesn't know who. And he tries to follow clues. You know, maybe that will bring him some closure if he knows who did it. And then maybe if he could find out if that person's still around. He doesn't know what he would do when he finds that person, but, you know, he's got at least a little mystery to solve for himself. And that kind of keeps him going. So there's those two characters who are dealing with the loss of loved ones too. All right. Now, then there's an entire story arc with another character named Derek de Longren. And while he was out hunting with his hunting party, the giants came in and completely wiped out a city. So he comes back from his hunting expedition. The city is just full of crows and bodies, right? Now, everybody he knows and everybody that in his party, you know, everybody that they knew and loved has been slaughtered. They've all got to deal with this grief now. And they go down a darker path. They are thinking only of revenge, which is, you know, it's a thing that happens, right? That's one of the ways that grief manifests itself, that you get so angry. Anger is one of the stages of grief, and you could just stay there, get stuck, you know, and that's kind of what happens to them. And so we see that contrasted with the way other people are trying to deal with grief. And in the case of Fenton, the bard, he is dealing with this trauma that he can't forget. And so he has to practice, I actually kind of adapted a fairly common practice that is known as mindfulness now. And in the novel, he gets advised by a priest of the Gale that what you're doing is practicing presence. You're going to live in the present. You're going to acknowledge that the past exists and it's there. But be super aware right now of what's going on in the present, and notice that what is going on in the present is not that stuff that traumatized you in the past. And very slowly, it's work. It's not just a snap your fingers and, oh, I'm better. It's never that, right? It's
Wouldn't
never,
that be
ever.
Great? You
know, right. But that's not how our brains work, right? That's just not how we're built. Well, right?
The pharmacological industry, our pharmaceutical industry has tried to solve that.
Yeah. Or, you know, I mean, and then there's another way, you know, people compensate, right? They try to cope with substances of various kinds, you know, you name it, right? There's a lot of self-destructive behavior that can manifest itself after something traumatic. So, this guy is trying to tell them, look, mindfulness is going to, or practicing presence is going to help you. Just being super aware. You're not suppressing the past. You're not, you know, trying to pretend it doesn't matter. You're just going to say, look, that was there and is still there in my mind, but it's not here right now. Right now, there is, you know, a couple of cool people that I'm talking with right now. And whatever is bugging me in my past, it's not as cool as these two folks I'm having a conversation with, right? So I'm going to, you know, emphasize that positive thing instead of what was in the past. And I'm also not going to worry too much about the future, but that's another thing. I have a whole thing in Curse of Krakens about worry. It's a in fact, I think I'm going to read that chapter now as for your Patreon folks, is how do we deal with worry? There's those folks that I mentioned. We also have another character named Hanuma, who had actually been, injured for a very long time, due to what happened to a building fell on her and her family. She survived and her family didn't. And she's been on her own quite a bit as a result, because she's been living in the mud down by the river, you know, for a very long time. When she finally is able to have her circumstances improved, she is so loving and giving and charitable to everyone, because she knows what it is like to have nothing. And, you know, and that's an interesting phenomenon, right? Is that the poorest folks give the most to charity. It's a very common thing, actually, that people who have known true hardship have so much empathy for others and give as much as they can of themselves to help.
Yeah. It's like, I've experienced that here in Ecuador in terms of people who are living not necessarily in complete squalor or anything like that, but, you know, very, very modest means tend to be the most generous and open and welcoming, and will, urge you to feed, be like, eat as much as you want, you know, enjoy what we have is yours kind of thing. And I like that you're able to sort of explore so many different avenues of dealing with grief, whether it's openness and kindness and charity, or revenge and addiction and abuse and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Last episode, we were talking about you putting yourself into the mindset of a porridge-eating villain.
Oatmeal, Adrian.
Sorry. Yeah, oatmeal. It's not even porridge, you know?
Right.
But how has it been for you in order to write these characters and create such varied explorations of human emotion and human experience, but having to kind of put yourself in that mindset and you know, not even necessarily taking grief and trauma from your own experience and putting it into these characters, but creating and living in fictional experiences and fictional grief, and the ways in which people deal with that. So has that been challenging for you?
Well, I've had no problem accessing it, but sometimes you got to sit down at your computer with a box of tissue, because man, you know, you can get some waterworks going pretty easily. And there's, you know, Talon DuBole who lost her husband, and now what she wants to do is make sure as much as possible that her young boys have a good impression of who he was, even if they don't remember him very well, and that they know that he loved them deeply, and that they are you know, supremely cared for, and that his absence doesn't mean that, you know, they were not loved by him, you know. So that's another, you know, aspect. Everybody's got something, some kind of loss that they're dealing with, and then how they're approaching it. So I've had a whole bunch of, you know, different folks that have left this world in different ways. And some of them are fantastic, fantastic, loving people that never get the credit for who they were and they should have, you know. And then, I've seen people decline over time. Some people decline very quickly. I've seen people taken out by car crashes, things like that. So it's all of it is difficult to deal with, you know. And you see, I've even had, you know, a cousin who died, unfortunately, very violently. And that was a rough time to go through. So all of that stuff has kind of informed the different approaches that we see in the Seven Kennings and the many different characters who are dealing with various traumas that, you know, a lot of us kind of sort of collect. You know, the longer you go, the more it's going to kind of be present in your life. And you have to, you know, figure out a way to deal with it. And none of it is simply forgetting, you know, or pretending it didn't happen or whatever. You know, there's no magic eraser or anything like that. So, how we deal with that is something that I return to it again and again. And there's this priest of the Gale. His name is Kindon Ladd, who shows up over and over to help out different folks because his particular religion is a religion of peace. And these are folks who are like, you know, desperately seeking some peace because their emotions are so tormented. So he helps them out as best he can. And he's got his own issues too, which he reveals in A Curse of Krakens. So, yeah. Did I answer your question? Again, I feel like I rambled on
you. No, that's great. Well, and you mentioned, you know, sometimes when you're, you know, sitting down and writing, you got to sit down with that box of tissues because you need to be ready for... A, putting yourself in the character's shoes, but B, kind of what bubbles up in yourself and your own experiences as you are kind of pouring those things into your character. You know, I always jokingly say that, you know, I hand out my own flaws like party favors to my characters. But we do that with our flaws, with our experiences and our emotions too. So I want to talk about the physical, like the act of writing and how, you know, for you, how does that kind of introspective, very isolated nature of the profession that, you know, we've chosen here, does that allow you to more deeply process these emotions? And like, what are some of the upsides and downsides of being able to process those strong emotions in your work?
This is going to be like, okay, there's this band called Dragon Force that does this super speed metal stuff, and they kind of became famous through Guitar Hero.
Yes. Everybody's through the fire effects, that song. Right?
but they have a lot of other songs that are fantastic, and one that I've written repeatedly to is Valley of the Damned. And a lot of their lyrics, like if you did, you know, those little word bubbles where, you know, you see certain words that are bigger because they get used often, and Dragon Force's lyrics have a lot of repetition of the same sorts of words. You know, they're talking about freedom and justice and blah, blah, blah. You know, all kinds of, you know, high-minded things. And I listen to Valley of the Damned quite a bit whenever I'm writing some action scenes and some the heavy emotions that go in with mortal conflict. But then I will listen to other kinds of music as well while I am, depending on the kind of scene that I'm writing. And that helps me in terms of my process to get me in a certain headspace because there's different moods associated with different music. But I will also change where I write. Right now I'm coming to you from my office with just, you know, hey, I've got some curtains. Woo, wow. Great interior decoration there, Kev. But I've got, I write all over the place. I often will, if I am stuck, in fact, I will often purposely go somewhere else and have different environment in hopes of, you know, dislodging some whatever's stuck in my head. So I will go to, the outside deck if the weather permits. It's not going to permit that for very much longer. and then, that little thing.
That was cute.
Those of you who are watching the video.
There's a little thumbs up.
A ghost thumbs up. If you put your in this new Mac operating system, if you do a thumbs up, it'll just say, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and echo you with another thumbs up. And it puts a little graphic up there for no reason at all.
You live in Canada, everybody. Deal with the winter. Thumbs up.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I will get, you know, move myself elsewhere, and that helps my writing process a little bit. But mostly the mood is carried off by music. I write a lot of my stuff to Polyphia, which is an instrumental metal band, and I have a playlist that's hours and hours long. And yeah, it's spelled, for everybody who would like to check them out.
Tommy, grab the pen.
Yep, it is spelled Polyphia. And MJ, you got to go check out a song called Ego Death, because Ego Death by Polyphia, with special guest appearance from Steve Vai.
Ooh.
So
is that the guy who did music for Halo?
Yeah, maybe he did. I'm not sure.
I think he's a guitarist, and I think he did
He's a huge guitarist.
Bunch of stuff for Halo, like the Halo video game series.
Yeah. So anyway, check that out if you'd like. I've written probably, I don't know, 10 novels to Polyphia now.
Wow.
It's my happy place.
Damn. I love it. As soon as you said instrumental, I was like, tell me more.
Exactly. They're great for that, because I like the instrumental moody stuff, because it will not interfere with the words that are trying to get out of my head by putting other words in. Sometimes I actually do Zen spa music kind of stuff, you know. You got somebody just leaning on an organ on one chord for 5 years. And that kind of puts me in a mood sometimes too. So,
yeah. And I like that music, because obviously there are some authors who don't write to music, but others who do, I purposefully choose my music to kind of, like you, to reflect the mood that I'm in. And I feel like that helps me to kind of engage myself more deeply in the subject matter that I want to write about. It's kind of like this amplifying effect of one creative act in the form of music, kind of ingratiating itself into my mind and my soul, so that I'm able to better capture the emotions that I want to write about in that particular scene. And I think that's something that's really poignant about writing, is that, you know, we can reflect upon the real world in very powerful ways, but we can also have a lot of fun doing it. So I think it's like, it's really challenging to deal with some of the subject matter. But there is this upside of, like, fiction is fun. A lot of the time it's fun. Storytelling is meant to be, an enjoyable experience for the most part. Sure. There are some torturous stories out there. But it is so cool that we can use words to evoke these feelings in people, give them a really good time, and at the same time, like we were talking about in terms of like fantasy, sci-fi, horror, and fiction in general, giving people those tongs to deal with heavier topics through the lens of something that is not so
immediate.
Immediate. And close to the pain and that kind of thing. And I wanted to ask you, in terms of, you know, writing process and whatnot, how might grief or trauma actually stop or, you know, slow a writer down when it comes to sitting down and writing and actually doing the thing? Because I feel like we can put so many hurdles for ourselves, more so than the outside world creates hurdles. For the most part, it's like all the hurdles that we writers deal with are mental. And so how might grief or trauma affect the ability for a writer to just sit down and write?
Yeah. In a lot of ways, you are, when you're sitting down and you're trying to process your own stuff. Yeah. You're trying to face this stuff that a lot of times people try to suppress, and you have to find a way to kind of access that without damaging yourself anymore, you know? And, it is tough, man. I know that during some of the, you know, some of the recent years, and during which we've all lived through the pandemic or whatever, You know, I realized I was drinking more than I was probably healthy. And I also knew from news articles that I was not alone in that problem. A lot of people were self-medicating to dealing with the fact that, gosh, we've lost kind of everything here to a virus that could have been stamped out if we had actually locked down for long enough, but we never did. And now it's endemic and we're going to have to get vaccinated forever. So it's going to keep mutating and keep messing us up. And the long version of it is going to be creating a giant swath of disabled folks from in different ways. They're disabled in different ways from it, you know, and it's going to be a part of our world now. So, you know, I was, you know, accessing dark stuff, you know, through that lens for a while. And, you know, now I just said, you know what, I'm gonna stop that. That's probably not good. So I haven't had a drink in over a year now. So it is just but I understand. I deeply get everybody who is, you know, self-medicating with anything at this point. Because you're not sure what to do sometimes. You know, you got to talk with somebody, or you got to get it out on the page, or you got to do something to deal with it. You know, get those tongs, gosh dang it, and figure out how to grapple with that thing. So I think that the trauma stuff and the worry stuff, all of that really helped me quite a bit. And from what I can tell, just based on folks coming to talk to me, it's helped some other folks too. So, yeah, I've had some pretty emotional conversations while I was on tour for A Curse of Krakens. You know, people just saying, yeah, that what you wrote about in A Plague of Giants helped me deal with the passing of, you know, fill in the blank. And I'm so glad it did, you know. It's one of the best things when you find out that a story you wrote is actually helping somebody else out with a tough time. So. Yeah, it's not just entertainment. It's actually being helpful somewhere and making them think in a different way. And that is the power of the words, like you were saying, Adrian. You know, words have that power to unlock stuff in ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things we wanted to ask you, actually, is just like if you had moments where readers, whether in person or online, told you that your work helped them through tough times. And you know,
yeah,
I can imagine for you, like how
what that feels like, what that means. Yeah.
Yeah, in person, it's a little like they start to tell you, and then they get very choked up about the fact, you know, of you know, basically sharing that with someone who is a stranger, but maybe they got to know me through the page. You know what I mean? So, but they're starting to tell me, and then they have difficulty getting through it all, and I'm like, no, it's okay. You know, God, I understand, and I'm you know, I'm so glad it helped, and So yeah, there's some tears there and so on. And I'm just so happy that helps. There's two, then I get emails, of course, from various folks. Some folks were like, I'm still here because of what you wrote. And I'm like, wow, thank you. I mean, I'm so glad the story helped. That when you're sitting down, you're writing, you never think that what you're doing could just connect with somebody in that perfect way, you know, because of what they're bringing to it, right? So there's that. There's you get letters sometimes, you know, in person. I've had people who know that they're going to see me in person, and in person, all they're going to say is thank you, and that, you know, because they don't trust themselves to say anymore, but they said it in this letter, and they give you the letter, and then you read it later, and you're like, holy shit, that person just said thank you to me, but here's this, you know, letter where they explain what had been going on in their lives and how my book helped them out. And so that's super special, and I really appreciate that. And I understand sometimes the impossibility of saying things out loud sometimes, especially if it was traumatic, and putting it down on paper is safer somehow. And just handing over that letter is a safer way to say things than to try to vocalize it. So I'm glad that I could be there just to receive the letter in that case, you know? And then afterward, you know, after they've said the thing, whatever, then later on in social media, they'll say, thank you. You know, again, you know, just 'cause they feel better for having, sometimes you just got to say it, you know?
Yeah.
Even if it's just two words, just thank you, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, and I've thanked writers that, you know, that I really appreciate for how they helped me with something, you know, and I just go up to them and say, you know, thank you for the story, you know, not necessarily needing to explain how they helped me, but I really feel a deep need to thank them. You know what I mean? Like, and it might not sound like a big deal to them, but it's a super big deal to me to thank them because of all the stuff that story meant to me that I can't possibly express. I get it on the other side. You know, when somebody has to tell me thank you, I get that there's a whole bunch more that they're not saying, and that's cool. It's fine. I want to be there to be thanked if they feel I need to be. And I deeply appreciate that, you know, they read my story and it helped them out. So there's actually a bit about this in Plague of Giants. This guy understands that, you know, there's this line of people come up to him and thank him because he knows that he's probably going to save a bunch of their lives because he's super powerful and they are not. And they are, you know, they could be crushed if he's not going to be there to help them. So they come up to thank him. And one of the other characters says, why do you know, this is a big, you know, sort of drain on your time and energy. And he says, no, I need to be here to be thanked because it's necessary for them and it's good for me too, because I know that I'm going to also have to suffer in this part, but it's good to know why, you know? So yeah, everything about the whole transaction, I guess. So not transaction is a terrible word, but everything about the experience of writing and reading is a thing that goes on sort of in isolation, but wow, does it bring us together at the same time, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. I mean, that for me is one of the most beautiful parts of this, is that there is the isolation, but it goes hand in hand with community and socialization. And I think with grief and trauma, it is really important. Obviously, it's very difficult for a lot of people to take that grief and that trauma and bring other people into the inner circle of honesty and openness and to allow them to kind of carry a bit of that burden. And I think that's such a beautiful thing about fiction, is that it opens the door, even if just a crack, for people to understand that life is worth continuing to live, or a simple thank you goes a long way, or, you know, sharing with other people and family and friends the things that you're going through can change a lot, and a lot of the times it's for the better.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think those interactions are so incredible with the readers. It's such a, when you write the book, you're so far removed from the reader at that time. And when you're right, they bring their own experiences to it, and it creates something wholly unique, right? The experience of them reading it is creating new art that's different from the art that you created when you wrote it. Which, yeah, it's just a beautiful thing for processing a whole host of emotions for us. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I wanna bring in some positivity here at the end, bringing it in. So as we're winding down,
energy. It's not even the afternoon, energy. And you're so,
I know. Look at this. Look at this energy. It's 10:30. I'm infamous, Kevin, for being Grandma MJ, and I get tired when we record late. But I'm like, look at me go. It's the cup of tea I made. I'm telling you.
Did you put honey in it?
I didn't, but it was black tea. So I'm going to be up till like 4 in the morning. So winding down though, what is grief without joy, right? We need the whole spectrum of human emotion. Wow. So Kevin, let's close out. What is something that brings you joy in life?
Birds.
Birds.
Birds and dogs. Yes. Birds and dogs just all day. Yeah. I go birding quite a bit and have a bird feeder in my backyard, and it is one of those things, like, I didn't really care much about birds when I was younger, but I started to notice them more as I got older and how freaking cool they are. And I love to go out and and take my camera and shoot whatever I can with my camera. So just the act of getting outdoors is incredibly therapeutic. And if I see a cool bird I've never seen before, wow, do I get geeked out. Yeah. Man, first time I got a belted kingfisher. I went out to this bog, which, you know, I was reading all the – it was one of those little trails where they have little signs every so often explaining science to you. They're like, here's 5 meters. I'm in Canada. Meters, folks. It's the metric system. Here's get 5 meters of peat bog. And I'm like, just think of all the bodies that got to be buried in there, man. It's amazing. So you're kind of going along this boardwalk, because if that's not there, you can actually sink down in this stuff a little bit or a lot. And but there's these interesting trees that kind of grow up through there. And among them, in bushes, they have all these berries on them. And so there are cedar waxwings hanging around there. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with cedar waxwing birds, but the reason they're called waxwings is they're dang smooth looking. You can hardly see the little filaments on the feathers. They're the smoothest dang birds you've ever seen. And I had never seen one live and being able to take a good picture of it. So here I am in this bog full of death, and there's the most lively cedar waxwing ever. And I was like, this is the best day ever.
Click, click. Oh my God. This bird looks like it has a Snapchat filter on it. I mean, like, seriously. Yeah. Like, this bird, it's like obscenely smooth. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that
but at the same time, it's like it has like it almost looks like a Marvel superhero. It has like very like mask like features on its
it's a dope looking bird. All right, you're gonna get me into birding here, Kevin.
Well, you know, hey, no, here's the thing, MJ. You were going to anyway. I'm just starting it early. Yeah. You're going to get to that age and you're like, holy shit, birds are the best thing ever. Yeah. But if you start early, there's no penalty. It's fine. You can get going now. It's totally cool. There's an Instagram and Blue Sky are great for birds. You know, I see so many cool birds on a daily basis.
It of course, makes me the happy. Blue Sky is great for birds.
I was going to make that what they're attracted to.
Yeah. So yeah, if you guys want to follow me on Instagram and see my occasional birding stuff interspersed with my book stuff, you know, that's kind of what my Instagram feed is. It's birds, books, and tacos or whatever. So there you go.
The antidote to combo. Grief.
Yeah.
Birds and books and tacos.
Birds, books, and tacos.
And here's the thing. I mean, I don't want to say that anything is an antidote, but you know, all of the people in one way or another, whether they succeed or not in actually processing their grief, you know, the folks that do succeed they do so with the help of others, and they do so gradually over time. And it's going to, you know, continue to be a process. There's never a point at which they say, okay, I'm done now. That is a key thing to take away. But the thing is that they all do get better with that help and that processing. So, you know, that would be my hope, of course, for all the readers out there who, you know, whatever it is that you're dealing with.
Yeah. So, and like writing, it's all a process. It's all gradual.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Gosh, if we could write as fast as our readers read, whoo.
Yeah.
We'd be having some books out.
And Kevin, if you ever want to come down to Ecuador, there are plenty of birds down here. There are. Ecuador has the highest concentration of hummingbirds in the entire world. If you ever want to
love hummingbirds,
check them out.
They're so
beautiful.
Cute.
Yeah. There's one that has like this giant like hooked beak so that it can get into a particularly deep flower.
Into like one of those big old flowers.
Oh. Yeah, yeah. One of those big old flowers.
I know. I'm sorry. I think that's like I get made fun of. That's like the voice I put on anytime it's an animal of anything. It could be like an opossum or something. I'm like, "Oh, look it up." So, it's all right.
Hey, MJ, will you just talk to me a little bit about otters?
Will they hold hands? So they don't float away from each other. Did you know that?
Otters are the best.
They're so
I love otters.
Yeah.
Talk about your joy, man. Otters are rad.
Well, on this beautiful chirpy note, I love all this animal talk. That's it for this mini masterclass and our two-parter with Kevin Hearn. Thank you so much for healing with us and talking grief, but in the end, you know, bringing some positivity, and we really appreciate it. So thank you so much.
Appreciate y'all.
And as well, for anyone who contributes to our Patreon at $10 or more a month, there'll be a reading by Kevin from A Curse of Kraken. So go check that out. Go support his work. Kevin, where can folks find you online?
You can find me at Kevin Hearn on Instagram and also on Blue Sky. And of course, I'm at kevinhearn.com. And you're always welcome to email me anything you'd like using Kevin at kevinhearn.com.
Awesome. You can also follow SFF Addicts on Instagram, Twitter, and Threads at SFF Addicts Pod, or you can follow me at Adrian M. Gibson. MJ, where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me across all the socials at MJ Kuhn Books, all one word. And on my website, mjkuhn.com. And I always forget to say this, but if you sign up for my newsletter on my website, you get a free copy of my novelette, The Sham Wizard of Golden Dawn. So free books.
Pick it up.
Go check it out.
And not free books, but very much worth it. Among Thieves and Thickest Thieves.
If you like the free book, then maybe go check out the not free books.
Yeah. Yeah. They're beautiful. They're fun. Go enjoy it. All right. Thank you, MJ. And now, everyone, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.